Thanks, Jack. I appreciate the opportunity to come give you an update on our genetics of feedlot cattle health study. It's something I'm really excited about. Is that too loud? Okay. I'm pretty excited about this study. Unfortunately, what you're going to hear is like you read a book and the last 20 pages are gone. We've got still yet have to write those 20 pages because our analysis is really getting going. But I'll give you an update of where we're at and give you a little bit of a background of what we're going to talk about and some of the justification. This all started actually with the discussion that John Pollock and I had in a car one day along with Daryl Strobeen and Harvey Blackburn of the USDA germplasm program in Fort Collins. And we were discussing, what are the holes in our current evaluation? What don't we have EPDs for that we should? What are some economically relevant traits that might be worth spending some time doing some additional research to actually develop and provide some selection tools? And one of those was health. And we wanted to, as we developed the project, we wanted to narrow down the health problem or health item, if you will, that we wanted to focus on and give this as a start to maybe further research into the characteristics of feedlot health. As you can see here, there's a whole host of economic reasons why we decided to focus on actually bovine respiratory disease. It's a pretty economically relevant trait, and as any of you who have bought a bottle of some of the newer antibiotics to treat respiratory disease have found out, it's not cheap treat those cattle. So if we could do something to reduce the susceptibility to bovine respiratory disease, that has some value to the beef industry overall. So I'll give you a little bit of an overview of what I'm going to talk about, give you a little of a justification for the project, a little bit about its design, talk about our results relative to the incidence we have seen for bovine respiratory disease, a little bit about our work on characterizing this concept of disease or the concept of a sick animal, and then a little bit about the genetic results we found, and finally show you some of the influence we've seen as far as BRD on carcass performance. And I actually am going to talk a little bit about what our next steps are as far as analyzing this data. First, I want to recognize Pfizer Animal Genetics as the funder of the project. What you're going to hear today would never have been possible without their support. So I want to make sure they get due credit for helping us go down this road of trying to make a genetic improvement on susceptibility to bovine respiratory disease. So the premise of the whole study is that susceptibility, and I hesitate to use the word resistance. I put it in there because I'm not sure we're selecting for resistance. We're selecting for actually reduced susceptibility. That susceptibility to disease is in part genetically controlled, and we can characterize that control through the use of DNA markers and maybe indicator traits as well. So we believe in our background research that genetic control of susceptibility to bovine respiratory disease, what we see is, did I pull that animal or did the pen rider pull that animal or not? Did we have to treat that animal? Is actually a function of two different mechanisms in the individual. One of those is the ability of the animal to cope with stress. And we put them on a truck, these cattle we put on a truck and trucked them nearly 400 miles, dropped them off in the feedlot, new place, it was dusty and the temperature was fluctuating from day to night about 50 degrees. How do they deal with that stress? The other component we believe is an innate difference in those animals' immunological function to actually counteract disease challenges. And if you look at both of those, there's probably some relationships amongst those two factors that control whether we experience disease or they get pulled by the pen rider or not. So we're going to address all of those a little bit. I'm not going to go through each of these, but just to give you an idea of the scope of the study and all of the outcomes or phenotypic measures we took on the animals. We took a whole host of different phenotypes or measurements to measure morbidity, whether the animal was sick or not. And when you pulled an animal or the commercial yard pen rider actually pulled an animal, they went through quite an in-depth process of data that they collected on those, and my grad students actually collected. Then we got your typical performance traits, you know, got all the carcass measurements, hot carcass weight, marbling score, quality grade, We actually ultrasounded the cattle on arrival two more times in the feeding phase to look at different rates of fat deposition, whether the animals got sick or not. And then we also have some outcomes that were baseline stress and behavior characteristics, temperament from a flight speed and shoot score, I'll talk about a little bit later on. Some stress indicators that were based on physiological measures from biological samples we took, and then some baseline disease and immunological status measures. A little bit about the background. These cattle were fed over 2 years in a commercial yard. Actually, it's a JBS Five Rivers Cattle Feeding Yard in Lamar, Colorado. The first year, we didn't own these animals, and neither did Pfizer. Five Rivers bought the animals. Okay? From a research standpoint, you guys are going to think I'm crazy. We wanted to get 50% of the animals sick. That's our goal, is to end up with 50% treatment rate, because that's what we're dealing with. It's kind of like heifer pregnancy. Either heifer gets bred in the breeding season, or she's open at the end of the breeding season. This one is either treated or not. Okay? So the first year we didn't vaccinate on arrival. The second year we actually did. Even though a lot of our participants said that wouldn't have any effect on disease rate, and you'll see why that change was implemented here in a moment. Both year, you know, we tried to be as typical as we could with the procedures to mimic a commercial yard, or to mimic the commercial yard procedures. We used implants, you know, their normal protocol. And these are the numbers that we had. Just under 2,900 head went through in the 2 years. So a little bit about the results. Hey, year one. We almost got perfect from a research standpoint. 45% of those animals got pulled by the pen riders. Okay? And we were cheering. My grad students who were there treating those animals after the pen riders pulled them weren't cheering. But from a research standpoint, it was perfect. And you can imagine Five Rivers owning those cattle, they wanted them vaccinated the second year. All right? So that's why we got vaccination on the second year. In both these years, they were vaccinated on the ranch. I mean, so they followed appropriate protocols. They were vaccinated on the ranch. They were backgrounded. But in the first year, we had pretty tough weather. No rain for 90 days. There was dust everywhere. The wind was blowing. The temperatures were fluctuating. The cattle in the second year arrived about 2 weeks later. You know, it had rain, no dust in the feedlot. It was pretty good conditions. But if you look at what we ended up with, what I've split these out here is year one and year two, and this is our treatment and death summary. So this is the treatment rate. So 55% of the calves in year one we didn't treat. 33.5% got one treatment. 7.5% got two treatments. Now, two treatments could mean you treated them once, they passed our protocol 7 days later to go back to their home pen, but then they got pulled again, or they never left the hospital pen. And then we had 3.9% that received three treatments. And after three treatments, they were realized. That's anyway, the three treatments and that was it. Okay. Now, lost 6.2%, so pretty high death loss on that one. Year two, no treatment, 92.9%. Isn't this typical of the feedlot? 1 year you have a wreck, or if any of you guys have buy stocker cattle in, you have a wreck 1 year and not the next year. Well, that's what happened in the study. Lost 2.3%, and we only had 0.4% that made it to three treatments. And if you look at the literature relative to a bovine respiratory disease outbreak, it's pretty typical. What we've got here is the number of cattle pulled on a particular day. This is year one. You see a big peak at the front, then a couple little peaks of animals that get pulled later on. Year two, not quite as clear. Now, analysis of disease traits as we anticipated and as we continue to reaffirm our belief, it's not easy. Right? If it was easy, we'd have done it, got EPDs when we did birth weight and weaning weight and started out. So this isn't necessarily low hanging fruit, but I think we've got some encouraging results. Some of the challenges with disease traits, when you get into a wreck like that in a feedlot, what do we see? We see pen riders may pull deeper than you actually need to treat those and try to stem the outbreak. So the question you have then is, were the animals that got treated truly sick? One of the other questions you end up with is exposure rate. Now, this isn't like heifer pregnancy. I know this group of heifers went out with a bull, they got exposed, and they had the chance to become pregnant. Well, it's the bovine respiratory disease. You don't know if all of the animals in the pen were exposed to the same organisms to get sick. So that's one of the other issues involved with disease traits. And then finally, were there animals that were sick but never treated? You know, if you look at nature, and if you're a wildebeest in Africa, you don't want to look sick because the lion's going after you, right? Now, I got to go 12 years ago. I've been to Alaska once. Went fishing in the area. There were brown bears. There were four of us on the trip. We were kind of in a remote area. Two of the guys outweighed me by quite a bit. I figured, you know what? If there's a bear, I just got to outrun those two because they're the ones that are going to get caught. So it's nature says you don't want to be the one that's sick. So there's some mechanisms involved with animals that may actually get sick but just not show symptoms. Therefore, we never treat those. So there's likely some exposed, but they never exhibit clinical signs. So our goal, and what I'm going to report to you on today for the most part, is our ability to appropriately classify sick animals. Give us a better identification of animals that got sick, okay, whether they were treated or not, versus animals that stayed healthy the whole time or perhaps were exposed and fought the disease challenge off. And our goal is to improve an improved identification of animals that are sick, or a better classification is going to help us better develop tools to make genetic progress for these traits. So one of the ways that you start to pull apart this treated or not treated is to look at lung lesions. And lung lesions, that information is collected when the animals are harvested and they get a score from 0 to 3. 0 says we've got a perfectly normal set of lungs. A score of 1 says we've got some lung damage in less than 5%, no adhesions, and then you go on up to where you've got a lot of adhesions, a large percentage of the lung has some signs of damage. And if you look at some of the previous results, and I'll explain here, these are animals that were treated, these are animals that were not treated. Over here, if you collect those animals at harvest, you've got animals that show lung damage and animals that show no lung damage. Okay, you look at previous, there's two previous studies, one by Thompson in 2003 where they treated 26% of the calves, and then you've got Whittam in 96 that had a 35% pull rate. Remembering that our study had a considerably higher pull rate than year one. And you look at the animals that were never treated, never identified as sick, but 32% of those still had some lung damage. You look at the second study, not pulled, 50% of those animals, never in the feedlot, never treated, but still had some lung damage. Okay, now, we could argue that some of that could have occurred before it ever got, those animals ever got to the feedlot, you know, on the home ranch. If you go from there, the other component that's particularly interesting are animals that were treated and have no signs of lung damage. So you identified those, the pen riders pulled those, identified them as sick, and that treatment either solved the problem so they never experienced any lung damage, or the pen riders were pulling deeper and they really weren't sick animals. So if you compare this, and this is a means for us to look at the validity of our data and some of our lung scores, you look at year one and year two, so we actually physically put two people on the table at the slaughterhouse as the lungs went by. In year one, we could handle the lungs and give them a score. They went to our next independent evaluator. They scored them. So we had two scores on a set of lungs. You know, any of you ever been in a packing house, you don't have much time to look at something as it goes by before you got to get the next one. So, you know, you're averaging 2 or 3 seconds a set of lungs, but you get used to those things whipping by. What we ended up, if you look at our study, we ended up pretty much intermediate to this, even with a 45% treatment rate. 39% of the animals were not pulled but had some degree of lung damage. In year two, remember, we only treated 7.1% of those. We had almost 44% of the animals never treated but had some lung issues. If you then look at the animals that were treated but had no lesions, we actually had in the first year, which gives me some indication that maybe we were pulling pretty deep on those cattle, that we had almost 13% that were pulled and had no signs of lung damage. In the second year, where we had a considerably lower pull rate, we had about 3% that were pulled with no lung damage. Okay, so we looked at how can we better use those lung scores to actually pull apart how sick the animals were, or better classified disease. What we did is we looked at mean lung score between the two evaluators, and this kind of gives you a breakup. Here we had lung involvement, you know, greater than 15% of the lung damaged or showing some signs of lesions. Over 50% of those in year one we had such a high pull rate. Year two, only about 16%. So not a lot of severe lung damage. And then over here is the combined. Another way to look at it is like a pregnancy trait where they either had lesions or they didn't have lesions. 0-1, open or pregnant, if you will. And we saw that 70% in year one had some signs of lung damage, only 29% did not. And in year two, here was the breakup. Okay, so one of the things you want to know when we start to look at the genetic side of this, is there variability for the trait? Because if we don't have any genetic control of the trait, it's not going to be worth much for selection. Right? So we looked at the heritabilities of the lung scores, zero. So whether the animal had the various categories of lung scores, we didn't get any heritability. And whether lesions are present or not, only about 4%. Okay, so we took that information and said lung score isn't really telling us much about the genetics. But what it turned out is that treatment, just whether the cowboy or the pen rider pulled those animals or not, ended up 15% heritable. Now let me put that in perspective. We do a genetic evaluation for a number of breeds at Colorado State that deal with heifer pregnancy. The values we use for heritability for heifer pregnancy range from about 0.11 to 0.22. So this is about right in the middle of our heritability estimates for heifer pregnancy. So that to me, that's some exciting news. Right? There is some genetic variability on whether an animal gets pulled for bovine respiratory disease or not. So in all the differences we saw, 15% of that is due to underlying genetics, based on our estimates. And we only have sire information on these calves. We did it through DNA parentage. We had DNA samples on their sires and on all of the calves, and that's how we assigned the appropriate parentage. So then we looked at better ways to maybe classify disease, and we looked at, all right, let's look at the number of BRD treatments, so the number of times they were pulled for bovine respiratory disease, and then we built a composite trait, even with the lung score information showing no heritability. And that's what, was an animal treated, or did it have an average lung score or lung damage of greater than 1.5, okay, or both, or none of them. So we had four categories. And we ended up with no treatment being about 4% heritable and the total BRD score still about 7%. So what that tells us at this point is the best expression of genetic differences is still whether that cowboy or that pen rider pulls an animal or not, identifies as sick. That's our best our most highly heritable trait. Okay, so once we look at this and our approach through the whole thing has been, one, we have to, if we're looking for tools and trying to develop tools and DNA markers that help us select animals that have a lower susceptibility, we have to have a trait that's heritable. Okay, the other thing is it economically relevant? And I already alluded to that. Anytime you treat an animal, there's a cost involved. And then finally, is this related to carcass and feedlot performance? And what I wanted to show you today, is, and this is only things that were statistically significant, looking at the three ways we settled on to characterize disease, you look at treatment, zero would mean they were never treated, or treatment one means they got at least one treatment. We're losing about 10 pounds of carcass weight, marbling score is about 11 points down, and in the scale we used, a 400 is a low choice animal, 400 marbling score. Fat thickness was reduced a little bit. Now, if we look at number of treatments, it does a little bit better job breaking down the effects of numerous treatments on hot carcass weight, where if you were an animal that went through three treatments, we were losing 50 pounds of carcass weight, which is pretty significant if you've got an animal that ends up that sick and keeps coming back for treatment. Ribeye area, not quite as much. In fact, some of the treated animals actually had a slightly higher ribeye area. Marbling score, we saw a reduction in marbling score, a little bit in fat. Marbling score here, about 11 points as well, if an animal not treated versus treated, and then our total BRD. But remember, this was the trait that showed the greatest degree of genetic variability. So, going back, remember that we talked about our theory that the disease or incidence of disease is manifests through two ways, either the ability of the animal, the innate ability to cope with stress, or the immunological ability to counteract disease challenges. So what I want to do is actually give you some preliminary results on some of our easily measured indicators of stress. And that has to do with some behavior traits. What we did, we took shoot scores on these animals on arrival, and we also did an exit velocity. Dr. Bob Weber from here at the University of Missouri came out on both those processing, set up his equipment to measure how quickly those animals left the chute. Pretty popular measure from what I understand in Australia. And you start to look at the heritabilities of all these traits, and they're probably a tad bit lower than some of the other estimates we have with perhaps better pedigree information, but it's still heritable traits. Okay? And if you look at the relationship between exit velocity on arrival and exit velocity at the second processing, you know, genetic correlation above 0.7, kind of like what we see with ultrasound traits. Ultrasound, you know, a lot of our ultrasound traits are 0.7 genetic correlation with actual carcass traits. Okay? So, pretty encouraging results relative to some of these behavior and temperament scores. Now, we haven't completed the analysis relative to is behavior related to whether an animal gets treated or not, but we're supposing that animals that are a little more flighty are probably under higher levels of stress. And we actually have some physiological samples that we're using to measure stress. Unfortunately, all of the assays aren't done. When you ship some of these university labs, our own included, 3,000 samples, it tends to overwhelm your research technician or your grad student. So we're still working through all of those. But some, you know, we saw what you would expect for heritability of some of the behavior traits. So then the question becomes, all right, if we're looking for DNA markers, how much of the variability can we see with the DNA information? So we've run the 50K SNP on all of these animals, and actually through the National Beef Cattle Evaluation Consortium and Dr. Garrick's participation in that, we've run some preliminary heritability estimates on the disease traits. And they're very much in line in the range of 0.2 like we saw with our traditional quantitative techniques. So to me, that's encouraging that we can explain some of that phenotypic variability with these markers. The predictive, I think Dorian used the word predictive ability of these, they're slightly predictive as to compared to very predictive or not predictive. So that's, to me, encouraging as well. We still have a whole host of analysis to do once we start to get some of these other outcomes and lab results in. So in summary, we've seen that the heritability of susceptibility is a 0.15, similar to the heritability of heifer pregnancy. We've, as you would expect, and any of you who have retained ownership or own cattle in the feedlot, it affects feedlot performance. And so our next steps are to further start to pull apart the underlying genetic mechanisms associated with stress and immunological differences amongst the animals, to hopefully give us a set of markers and the ability to get good genetic predictions on animals that are more accurate. So if we combine all of this underlying cause for whether an animal, from what we see, actually gets sick or doesn't get sick, we have some tools that have some good accuracy relative to selection and hopefully reducing the susceptibility to bovine respiratory disease. So with that said, I want to make sure I acknowledge everybody that's involved. We have a really strong team put together to help us analyze this data and design the study. Guy Lonegren and then a number of people from CSU. We've got South Dakota State and University of Illinois involved. When we started this, John was at Cornell, but now obviously he's at the Meat Animal Research Center. And then, of course, Five Rivers Ranch Cattle Feeding and Dorian Garrick. And like Jim said, we couldn't pull this off without grad students. Brian Brigham is actually the lead grad student on this project and has spent a considerable amount of time out of his last 2 years treating sick cattle. And then we have a whole host of others, some from West Texas A&M and some from here at the University of Missouri, and they've all been very critical to pulling off this study. So with that said, I am going to take any questions. I will commend you for being here. The attendance here is better than the last week of my undergraduate class that I taught last spring. So I look at that as encouraging. So any questions? Yeah, Dr. Spitzer. Yes, they were temped when they were pulled, and a portion of those actually had a remote sensing bolus in their rumen to look at body temperature, but that was never used to pull animals. Not yet. We're not to that yet. Just on the verge. In about 3 weeks, we will have done that. Yes? That was on arrival. Yes, the vaccination occurred on arrival. It made the feedlot feel better, but most of the team of scientists that are better epidemiologists than immunologist than I am said, it's really not going to matter. But from the feedlot standpoint, it appears to have mattered. Yes, sir? The weight of the cattle was just a tad, I think it was 490 was the average weight when those cattle arrived. They were housed in the commercial yard. It's about a 70,000 head yard. Now, the first year they had cattle all around them. The second year, as most of you know, Five Rivers got bought by JBS. They were in the middle of that transition. So the feed yard was considerably more empty, the commercial yard, at that time in the second year than in the first year. And for the unlucky cattle, we had a group of cattle who were right next to the hospital pen in the first year. So we had some pretty good, I think we had bugs from all over the country in there. Same source. Same ranch source. Yes, sir. Brian. We have genetic information as far as sires. We ran DNA parentage. We have some dam information on about half of those, but one of the issues was that we didn't have a lot of repeat calves out of dams because we took a portion of that ranch's calves and we didn't always get, two calves out of the same dam. So right now we're sticking with mainly the sire side. I can't answer that. They're pretty much a composite, so I can't say that there are more Angus pulled or more Hereford pulled or less Hereford or less Angus. I can't answer that, Brian. Sire effect, we haven't tested the sire effect yet, but the heritability would say we probably have some pretty good sire effects.